A different future starts with you. That's why GoDaddy does more than help you find a name. You can create, sell, and get found online, so any small business could be a driving force to create change or build an empire. We know old ideas aren't cutting it anymore, so we're calling for a new generation of thinking, your way of thinking. So whatever you have in mind that will help make a different future, find everything you need to get started at GoDaddy.com. Because the future isn't decided yet. It's up to us to make it happen. Start different at GoDaddy.com.
If you've recovered from COVID-19 or unknowingly been exposed to it, you may have antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients. Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies. Visit Vitalant.org today.
This is an ode to Napa cabbage. Of all the cabbages on all the cabbage farms, only you have the crisp crunch worthy of our Bibigo Korean dumplings. No other cabbage would do, because no other cabbage tastes like you. We love you, Napa cabbage. Just don't tell Green Onion. Napa cabbage, one of many obsessively crafted ingredients in every hearty, flavorful Korean dumpling from Bibigo. Go handcrafted. Go Bibigo. Authentic Korean dumplings now in the freezer aisle.
This is Podco Media Networks.
It's the Innovation Podcast with Mark Reed Edwards and Garnett Harriman. Let's start the show.
Garnett, how are you doing today?
Great. How are you doing? How's your voice holding up?
Barely. The funny thing is, you know, it's like a little bit after 4 p.m. on the East Coast and it's almost dark here.
Well, that's the magic of, you know, the Earth orbiting the sun.
Well, I wasn't that, looking right? for you to explain it. I was just observing it.
I could draw you a diagram if you want.
I'm sure you could. Anyway, it's great to be back on this episode. And I don't want to steal the thunder of your intro for our guest, but something struck me on her LinkedIn page. She writes that she likes to invest with people who are building something bigger than an exit. And that just was a beautiful expression of an idea, I thought. I'll let you introduce her and get to the bottom of it.
I love it. I mean, and if she has anyone who is dismissive of the exit, I'll take the exit money and they can take the glory. Yeah, that works. That allocation works for me. So I am super excited. Aurelia is one of my new friends / colleagues here in Southern California after leaving New York. She's a real estate investor turned angel investor. She's an animal rights advocate and a vegan, and we share the animal rights thing. I think she's probably a lot more polished about it. I just get my bat and try to hit people who are not nice to animals. And then she's working in a very unique part of the venture ecosystem, which we will talk about soon. And that is in what I think is being called RBI, right? Revenue-based investments. So without further ado, I have Aurelia Alvarez on with us. Thank you, Aurelia.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here. And I'm very excited and honored to be part of this discussion. And just to kind of circle back a little bit on that whole bat thing, been there, done that before. But
well, you know what we call that bat back east? That's a persuader.
You usually don't change people's hearts for long term when you use a bat. So I figure, hey, a little bit of negotiation might go a little bit longer way.
There you go.
That is still reserved for once in a wild type of instance. Very rare.
Sure. Every now and then you have to, what is it? It's saber rattling. You have to show the sword. You don't necessarily have to use it.
Garnett, I remember you telling me like a year ago that you weren't an empathetic person. And I said to you, you have a dog.
Yep.
You are empathetic. If you have a dog, you have empathy because a dog relies on you for so much.
Yeah. I think really, no, look, I appreciate it. And I think you're probably on point on some level. I feel like I have way less empathy for humans.
I know that.
but partially it's because of that dependency, right? I don't want to go off on a tangent. You know, I'm sure Aurelia will have something way more polished to say about her advocacy and stuff like this. But, you know, the thing that has always weighed heavily on me is, you know, how dependent on our beneficence and our daily love and care and structure that animals who are domesticated animals. You know, there's a whole other range of animals. But really, just recently, I've started to feel really, really upset about zoos. And I've started to feel very strongly, like in the last year or two, that basically zoos serve no real purpose per se. Anyway, let's talk about that when you're ready to talk about it. But no, welcome.
It's good to have you here.
It's great to have you here. And I feel like wonderful that you put that up on your bio. And we'll devote at least a few minutes to talking more about that. Usually the way we like to start is no one makes it onto this podcast without being unique and diverse in terms of their experiences.
Except for me.
wait a second. Your experiences have been across the board diverse, like in a lot of ways. I was using diverse in the non-cultural sense, more in the word sense. And so we like to get some backstories. If you walk us through some of your background, some of your upbringing, whatever that led you to this point in time and to doing the unique set of things that you're doing.
Absolutely. So it's interesting. I share with people that my background has definitely been very non-traditional. I never, ever envisioned myself to be in the venture sector because as an undergraduate, I was a political science major that really went into that field to try to understand the whole dynamics of power, society, and government. And so initially, I had the idea that I would become an attorney and really advocate for those that did not have a voice. That was my initial plan.
Boy, you hit it on the head. I had no idea we had so much in common. That's my entire upbringing from like age 15 till becoming disillusioned around 23 or 24.
In fact, I even did I was part of a very prestigious legal fellowship as an undergrad as well. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is my calling. But then I figure, how can I actually start enacting change even at a greater scale? And during that research, that's really when I got introduced to the investment world.
Hey, do you remember, and you don't have to answer if you don't want to talk about this as far as like dating yourself, right? But I have no qualms telling people how ancient and decrepit I am in some ways. So when
I'm older than you, so that really worries me.
Those words sting. Do you remember going through undergraduate as a pre-law major? I was a pre-law major when that actually existed. It doesn't exist anymore, right?
I mean, it doesn't exist anymore.
But you know what I'm talking about. That was like a big thing when you were in high school. You were going to be pre-law or pre-med or whatever.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think that was the sentiment across a lot of those poli-sci majors, at least at UCLA it was. But then as we started graduating, it's like, oh, never mind. I don't think, you know, again, there's different ways of making change. There's different ways of having an impact. But for me, that was not necessarily the best way to go about it. So when I graduated back in 2008, in the middle of this whole housing recession, I just thought to myself, that's really when it got very curious to understand how does this whole finance investment world works. And that's when I started getting introduced to more of the economies of different markets and regions. So anyways, to fast forward, like 2 years later, I got introduced to real estate investing. And that's really when I started, I would say, really when my career took off. And when I say a career in real estate investing, that meant like because I was part of a team, we were buying houses, buying and holding, and we were doing some flips along the way, like a couple years later. But it's interesting because I felt that during that journey, our team would only win when other people would lose their homes. And you know, that there's something there that just didn't sit right with me.
You're pretty much just defined real estate investing.
And then I was like, oh my gosh, I thought I was going to go in there because I was like, I understood the power of finance at that point, but then it's like, well, you know, just writing checks to nonprofits or some type of philanthropy work can only do so much. And I did a little bit of soul searching during those years. And then it was just sheer coincidence. I got presented with an opportunity to purchase a vineyard that was like 5 years ago almost. I purchased my first vineyard and it's unbelievable because I was never involved in that type of sector. And so during that whole running a vineyard, I got introduced to an amazing team that really show me the light when it comes to anything dealing with sustainability. That's when I took a whole appreciation of.
You know, what's big in that space is mm-hmm. this notion of biodynamic farming. I've had some exposure to that over the years.
Yes.
Where's the vineyard or vineyards that you're involved with? Which part of California? I'm guessing yeah. California. But
yeah, so it's two of them are in Southern California. The other one's in Kodai.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I guess it's just the same analogy of when you have one potato chip, you really can't have one. It's like you kind of get in this habit of, I want one more, and that's really how that turned out to be. Funny thing is I really didn't know too much about wine per se or like the whole viticulture. But during that journey, that's really when I had a team that mentored me along this whole way. And about 2 years ago, I did exit the day-to-day operations from that business. And that's when I said, oh my gosh, again, it's interesting because the viticulture industry was really what introduced me to the concept of sustainability. And that's when I actually discovered this whole idea of impact investing, like using your capital, well, number one, to make money, and secondly, to make impact as well. Like they don't have to be exclusive. You start doing your research, you start asking the right people, then ta-da, I got connected with Founders First Capital Partners, and that's where I landed. And that's where I'm currently at right now.
So I've heard a similar backstory about folks who wandered into this danger zone of impact investing that we're all in, except that they didn't own the vineyard. They just drank the wine, got drunk, and then got involved with impact investing. But you seem like you had a much more thoughtful approach to it.
Yeah, and I wouldn't necessarily say it's thoughtful, but it's so interesting because this whole thing with viticulture, when you look at the agriculture enterprises, specifically with the wine industry, there's so much destruction, unfortunately, that happens to the land. But then there's this small segment that's really trying to understand why, if we really want the best wine that we claim that we want, if we want to be able to say we have the best terroir, why are we actually using so many chemicals? We're actually destroying the land. And that's actually what makes the wine. That's really what...
That's a great point.
Levels, right?
That's a great point.
That's when I got introduced to the whole thing with regenerative agriculture, biodynamic farming, as you had mentioned yep. earlier. So that's actually where the better and finer wine is coming from. So those aha moments, it's like, we actually do good for the planet. You produce something that's a quality. You produce something that actually has real value.
Here's a funny aside. Maybe you've had a similar experience. The best vegetables, in particular tomatoes, that I've ever had were on vineyard. You know, they came from vineyard gardens.
Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing what folks who know the land can do with things, you know, even beyond grapes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's, again, it was definitely not a linear path. But it's just the type of learning that you that happens. And I think that's very important because it does expose you to different modalities of thinking. It gives you different perspectives of life.
Absolutely.
Because now, even now as an angel investor myself, it's like when we are in angel groups, oh my gosh, I can tell you everything about ag tech, but that's only because I was part of the daily operations of this like larger agriculture enterprise, right?
What an amazing background. And it's when I think about it just on a timeline, it may be not so nonlinear actually, because everything is organically related to what came before it. And there's a widening of the frame that happened from land, from this zero sum, if I win, someone else loses, you know, to different types of sustainability focuses. And, you know, so what strikes me, Aurelia, is that at each phase, you know, even if they've been non-traditional segments that in the overall path, it feels like you just keep widening the frame and widening your perspective and widening your intelligence towards doing bigger things, more impactful things. Kudos to you.
That's the way to put it.
So let's dig right in, because you're doing something really cutting edge. And I would love to learn more about that. Founders First Capital is where you are right now. And they have a unique approach to investing in the venture ecosystem. Tell us more about that model and about the provenance of that model and what you guys are doing that's different. And I'm sure the audience is going to want to know.
Absolutely. I've been with Founders First Capital Partners closer to 2 years by now. So Founders First, by definition, we are impact-focused venture fund. But I think it's very important to share this with your audience right up front that we're definitely different from other venture funds because we're not necessarily looking for those big high-tech companies that are looking for that huge exit. We don't have anything against those type of companies. I think they are definitely much needed in our ecosystem, but we're not going after those ones, right? Our focus is more on smaller businesses that might have been overlooked by maybe more of the traditional financial institutions, including the more traditional VC model. So that in our case, we look at service-based businesses. And I think a lot of people might say, oh my gosh, how can you guys work with service-based businesses when they're not going to give you that 10x multiple? But you're right, they won't give us that 10x return, but they will give us that 2 to 3x return when we're able to partner with them to really build sustainable and profitable business models. So what exactly does that look like? So for example, like we'll work with companies that are small as 50K. We provide them with mentorship. We do introduce them to venture level resources. I think that's very, very important to mention that there is power in the VC model, right? There's lots of power, but it's really about how you deploy it. So for example, like we focus on like the strategies and tools that are being introduced to like the bigger companies. That's exactly what we use for our smaller businesses. And so when people keep hearing all the success stories of how we're scaling small businesses from 50K to $1 million, like in 13 months, it's not magic. It really isn't. It's just that we do have a tech-enabled performance platform that allows them to say, this is where you guys are at right now. And this is what has to be done differently moving forward if you want to hit that $1 million in annual revenue in the next 12 to 13 months. Right. So that's really we take very strict methodology as far as how is it that we're scaling the small businesses.
This is interesting to me. I had thought that maybe RBI was adversarial with venture debt investing the way you're doing it was adversarial with traditional VC. It doesn't sound like it is. Sounds like it could be synergistic.
It's not. And I'm happy that you brought that point because we're not anti-VC. I tell you that.
I am. And Mark Reed Edwards is very much anti-VC.
But I think that there is a place, right? There's a place and a timing that's right for VC, but it's not appropriate for everyone. I think that's very important to understand because unfortunately that VC model has been designed for a specific type of model. And it has been very exclusionary.
That's right.
So that's the reason when we
said, how do you mean exclusionary? I think you should be really, really frank and open here. Is it exclusionary from the standpoint like the size of the company or the color of the founder or the gender of the founder? How do you mean it?
Yeah. So both of them. So for example, if a company is not going to be generating minimum $100 million anytime soon, it's just not going to fit the VC model because it's not going to give you that huge return, number one. And secondly, the VC business really is a relationship business. And oftentimes that means that if you don't have those warm intros, if you don't belong to a network of people that are in those circles, it's going to be very difficult to be able to break into that VC model. And to even take it a step further, for example, if you look at who's actually running those venture funds, those bigger venture funds, it tends to be people who are not diverse, who don't come from historically underrepresented communities. And it's just our human bias that we tend to invest in people that look like us, that remind us of us. But that's, again, that's just in the inherent bias that has been built into this investing model.
I think the reason why Mark is letting me do this interview is because he feels guilty.
Why is that?
He looks like those VC guys that you're talking about.
You said to be very frank, and this is not to say that non-diverse folks are not accepting or anything like that. You know, looking back at even at my own personal career, like I've some of my best mentors also include people that don't necessarily look like me. But when we look at that VC business, it just has, unfortunately, it's been funneled in such a way where even if there's other people that don't necessarily reflect those characteristics that it was intended to serve, they're just kind of being kept out, you know? But again, people don't have to look like me to be able to say, hey, I understand where you're coming from. I think it's always important to have that diverse voice and diverse perspective, even from people that don't identify as diverse founders.
Enough beating up on VCs like Mark.
I am not like a VC. I am not a VC bro. I'm the furthest thing from that.
By the way, all joking aside, Mark is one of the best entrepreneurs and a bootstrap entrepreneur. You know,
yeah.
He puts his money where his mouth is, and he's built a business systematically, brick by brick, over the years with no outside Silicon Valley bro funding. all kidding aside, it's I think personally the reason why Mark and I get along so well and we work so well together is just that mutual acknowledgement of the sort of bootstrap entrepreneurship and the value of that and, you know, all those good things.
If you've recovered from COVID-19 or unknowingly been exposed to it, you may have antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients. Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies. Visit Vitalant.org today.
I want to swing back to, you call it revenue-based funding. I call it revenue-based investing. Mm-hmm. Because of my personal biases from the investor perspective. And I'm curious because I know it's part of the venture ecosystem, but I didn't realize, you know, not until speaking with you about it more and learning your perspective, I guess it really is sort of part of this larger impact investing response to to some of the challenges around the way VC has been done traditionally. So tell me more about, you know, how you view the history and the development of RBI or RBF and how Founders First Capital is doing things differently and what their flavor is.
Yeah. So it's interesting because I love the fact when you mentioned that, again, RBF is not anti-VC, because historically, if you actually look back, I'll go back to the 70s. I'm not that old, but, you know, but if you look back into the 70s, RBF funding was not made available to companies or even small businesses until they had actually raised VC funding first. So the logic behind that really is because RBF tends to be very founder friendly. It does not dilute the founder, which is a really nice thing. And if you're thinking about this, like from the founder's perspective, is you want to make sure that you retain as much ownership as possible of your company for as long as possible. Not to say, oh my gosh, I want to keep as much of a decision power making during this process, which you do, but that's not entirely the case. But when you're able to preserve as much ownership of your business early on, you're going to have way more economic control, right? So for example, like if you give up too much of your ownership before you even hit like a Series A per se, let's say you've bootstrapped enough, but now you're like at $1 million in annual revenue and you say, hey, it's time for me to kind of take it to the next level and I might be considering VC funding. Well, check this out. The VCs or any other investor, really, they're going to be looking at how much ownership do you have of this company. And if you've lost too much ownership, from the investor's perspective, they might be thinking, this founder might not be as vested or as interested in scaling this business if they don't have too much skin in the game, right? And so I share that because I think it's, again, it's very important. Like keeping as much ownership of a business is such a huge deal, especially for us with Founders First, because we're serving and we're working with small business owners that identify as diverse. And so when you look at diverse communities, there's a huge disparity when it comes to the wealth gap. And so in order for us as the impact focused fund to really be able to change those dynamics of that disparity, it's not about just writing checks left and right. It's about how can we use the $100 million fund that we have in existence right now to be able to make sure that we create and build future generational wealth for the diverse communities. And part of that means building businesses that are sustainable, profitable, and that those owners keep ideally 70% of that ownership in those companies.
Hey, so from a historical perspective, what's the difference between factoring, like the way it's done in certain industries like the garment trade and RBF, RBI?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So for factoring, I would say the major difference is they are buying your contracts ahead of time. And when they're buying your contracts, for example, your ARs, what they're doing is that they're changing that relationship. They're taking that customer relationship away from you, from the company. And that's now it's being transferred over to factory, to that company that's providing that type of funding. Whereas with Founders First or any other RBF provider, we don't touch your relationships with your customers at all. And with RBF, it's actually very flexible. So the way that you will be paying back that initial investment, it's based on your revenue that you've actually collected after delivering your service or your product. Whereas factoring, it's more focused on they're buying accounts from the people that you've already sold to. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. Really RBI, RBF, and for my money, you know, as an amateur historian of business models and revenue models and ways to make money, I wish I were a better historian because then I might be richer. But it feels like RBI, RBF is essentially a venture tweak or an equity tweak on a traditional way of funding ARs. And it's a sort of a blended or a hybrid model.
Exactly.
And I guess part of why I'm wanting to go back and take a historical perspective on this is, one, I have a similar training to you, which is to look at things from that through that political science, you know, lens and try to figure out what the big picture looks like. But also the tweak on factoring sort of inherently pushes you towards being an impact investor and being focused on diversity and focused on, you know, creating that generational, hopefully intergenerational wealth. Mm-hmm. There's something very organic about the progress from like a traditional AR funding tool to RBI. And mm-hmm. it organically leads you to that perspective that we know is kind of the future of exactly. investing, which is, mm-hmm. you know, diversity investing.
Mm-hmm.
So what's being funded? You know, what's the state of your funding and what kind of companies are you guys funding, you know, during and post COVID? I'd like to say we're post COVID, but I'm not sure we are.
So the companies that we're interested in funding, they are small businesses that have a B2B model, or they can even be like manufacturing companies. We have an appetite for that as well. They can be service based and it can be anywhere in the US. It's interesting because as an impact focused fund here in Southern California, we've gotten the question of, are you guys still writing checks, even though we're in the middle of the pandemic? And the answer is yes, yes, yes. So that's the beauty of being an RBF fund. It's more about like the whole thing. It's interesting. The ACA, the Angel Capital Association report came out 2 weeks ago, and they shared that 45% of startups or even early stage companies, unfortunately, are experiencing down rounds. And for that, for us as an RBF fund, that's pretty much very kind of a little bit of irrelevant, because for us, we're not necessarily leading rounds, but we're focused more on companies that are actually building something. Again, a small business that's building something that's sustainable, especially because we have that focus on service based. The way that we've partnered with them from the very beginning, with the idea of how is it that you scale amid financial constraints and in a rapidly changing environment, has actually allowed them to thrive and do very well given the pandemic. So as we're circling back with our portfolio companies, and I share this in the most humble way possible, a lot of our portfolio companies are actually adding team members to their companies right now. A lot of them are actually increasing their revenues. And for those that have actually pivoted, they're doing it in such a way where they've opened way more opportunities for themselves and for their team members that they necessarily had not anticipated before. And again, I think a lot of that comes from the idea that from the very beginning, when we started working with these small businesses, we always thought we're all about helping to mitigate risk. So it's more about like worst case scenario, if we were to hit a recession, you happen to lose your best channel partner or your best client, what does that look like? So from the very beginning, we've always led with mitigating risk.
That's amazing. I've been talking Mark's ear off this entire year. If my life were a venture, this entire year of 2020 would be a down round. You know, and I'm hoping for an up round in 2021, but we'll see. Do you, by the way, on that issue of the overperformance, I don't know how to describe it, the strong performance that you seem to be getting for most of your portfolio companies, were there any lessons learned that you can share with the audience, like general tips and tricks about how to survive and thrive even during a challenging situation like a pandemic caused by arch enemies?
Yeah, I would say...
I didn't name them. Did you see that, Mark? I didn't name the arch enemy.
Very diplomatic.
That would have been super racist. But
didn't you want to be a diplomat?
I did. Yeah.
Well, there you go. You are a diplomat.
There you go. Despite myself, I'm somewhat diplomatic.
That's funny. I would say, if I had to break it down to the top two lessons, and I think many people have heard this, but it's so true. It's number one, really know your customer, and have a meaningful relationship with your customer, because at the end of the day, the customer really is the person or the entity that's bringing you that revenue. So when this whole pandemic hit, as a business owner, you do have, I would say, an obligation to make sure that the market that you are serving, that you really are in tune with its needs. If their needs drastically change, and maybe you don't even have the capacity to serve those newer needs, it does not necessarily mean that you're going to be losing business long term, but seeing how is it that you can temporarily accommodate them. And if you can't temporarily accommodate those newer needs, always being able to lead with an abundance mindset and say, hey, we might not be the best provider for you right now, but let me connect you with someone else. And I think that's really when you start building or having a better understanding of where could I possibly pivot next, right? And secondly, I would say really knowing your knowing the competitive landscape of your market. That's also very important, because you have to really be in tune with what are the other folks in my same industry doing? Like, you don't have to compete against them at all times, but really understand how could I complement what's being offered there already. And I'll use a very specific example. So one of our amazing alumni, she has an etiquette school. So people would think, oh my gosh, who needs an etiquette school when we're in the middle of a pandemic?
Well, I do. According to colleagues like Mark, I need an etiquette school.
I've never said that.
But it's interesting. So she has experienced way more growth now during the pandemic. She's experienced way more growth now than she did in the last two quarters before we had entered this horrible pandemic. But I think it's interesting because her way of thinking of saying, hey, maybe I'm not teaching like all this Fortune 500, maybe I'm not offering them the same type of courses that I did once upon a time, but now there's a demand of like training and diversity and inclusion. And she's been able to make such a beautiful and seamless fit. And as a result, her business is booming. She can't keep up so much so. And that's the reason she's bringing on more team members as a result of that.
I love that business. I mean, all kidding aside from myself, I mean, I feel like I've seen versions of this in Europe. I've seen versions of it in Asia. This is kind of a universal thing. And is it just about business etiquette, or is there a broader frame in terms of like cultural etiquette?
Well, so her primary used to be business etiquette, but it has definitely evolved. For example, it's interesting because I know she was recently featured on The Doctors?
Yeah.
On COVID-19 etiquette. And I was like, oh, who would have...
That makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So when you and I first talked, I remember thinking you have a very good way with people, and you seem like everything you've done, and want to do, very relationship driven. And I'm curious how you apply that to building relationship with both investors and with founders, whether or not you're either investing with them or investing in them. How do you go about relationship building?
I love that question because I'm all about relationships. I tell people, the biggest type of capital that you can ever have is trust. And how is it that you build trust? You build it by building those meaningful relationships. I think it's so important for us, just in general, whether you're a founder, an investor, just us general humans, to really be able to seek out people that have an interest in that are mission aligned to whatever work is it that you're doing. because those are the type of people that I feel could definitely give you that insight as far as what could you be doing better, or who could I possibly connect you with that would allow you to amplify the work that you're doing. And again, I'm very big on building authentic relationships. Like, even if it's reaching out to someone that does not necessarily think like you or look like you, you know, just building that ecosystem that you're able to learn from other people's perspective is such a huge deal for me. I remember, I'll use a very specific example. We had, when I say we, that's my team and I. So we had a specific founder that had reached out to us that at that time, we weren't not necessarily ready to invest in just because they were so early on. But this specific founder did an amazing job of keeping me informed with their investor news, email newsletter. And I was actually one of those suckers that reads those type of newsletters. And I saw the growth that she was able to do like exactly a year later. Even though our fund did not necessarily invest in her, I was able to introduce her to another angel group and they were able to help her. So I think I share that as a specific example of when you really are out there building relationships with people that that align with your mission, that have an interest in seeing you grow as a human, that's really where a lot of that magic happens. So yeah.
Awesome advice. Knowing where you're located geographically here in Southern California, I'm curious whether you folks do any partnering or any collaboration with the folks at the UCSD incubators. There's a couple, I think, all run under the moniker of Starter, Start-R. You do mm-hmm. any work with Start-R?
That's a really good question. You know, it's so funny. So with Founders First Capital Partners, we are very welcoming of strategic relationships, you know, really being able to add value to the our local ecosystem. I've actually served as a judge for the UCSD Startup Accelerator before. I love the work that they're doing there. One of our portfolio companies happens to come from that accelerator as well, by the way. She's doing amazing work. But yeah, we do make sure that we support entrepreneurs at every stage, even though we are not necessarily investing in them. We do open our networks and our strategic support. We support them in a strategic manner. And if that means us mentoring them, maybe outside of our office hours, we're open to those type of partnerships as well.
So I just learned about Start-R and I'm super excited to be in dialogues with them about partnering with our investment stuff. And it just seems like it's a really, I don't know, really strong and supportive ecosystem that's being built up around entrepreneurs and innovators of color and female founders all around San Diego, which is, you know, as a non-Californian, that's a really, really pleasant thing to see. And I'm excited to learn more about it going forward.
Oh, yeah, they're phenomenal. I'll give a shout out to my portfolio company in this one.
Go for it.
So the company that came out of that accelerator, the one that you're speaking about, it's VC Cell Medical. And she actually happens to have gone through that accelerator program and she received mentorship through that program. And it's just amazing. Like the type of entrepreneurs, the quality of entrepreneurs that they're producing there is unmatched, honestly. It's a good place to do a lot of work in.
In all fairness, we should probably give a shout out to Kim and to Lada as well.
That's you.
So this has been an amazing conversation. And thank you so much for having joined us. Well, now we're getting to my favorite part of the entire podcast. And it's usually our last question. Uh-huh. And this is where you get the opportunity to stand up on a soapbox or on a pedestal and tell us what your biggest predictions are for the future. And then we monitor and analyze it. And then we come back and criticize you if you missed anything.
And pre-pandemic, this was always a question that people just, you know, talked, you know, way, way high up. But since the pandemic, people have kind of gone, oh, geez, the future. So we're interested to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, it's okay. It's funny that you mentioned that because I think that the pandemic has actually been an opportunity for us to really assess the way that we do business. I think it's been a way for us to assess our own personal lives and really understand what are the things that we should be prioritizing, what are the things that we should not be focusing on too much. You know, I've always received criticism, even from my own family. They think them sometimes a little bit too much of a pessimist because I'm always thinking about worst case scenarios. But I've always thought you have to think about worst case scenarios. You always have to be ready. If everything hits the fan, what is it that you're going to do and how is it you're going to respond? So I think this whole pandemic really served as a wake up call. I think moving forward, which I'm very excited about, I think there's definitely going to be greater focus and priority on anything dealing with sustainability, diversity, anything in the world of plant-based. Again, and I'm saying this because I'm a vegan myself, I think there's definitely, there's going to be a lot of opportunity in the plant-based sector. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing because, again, it ties back to the whole thing of really preserving the planet, which I'm a big fan about. But if anything, I think that the pandemic has definitely taught a lot of us how to be a little bit more empathetic, that maybe we weren't that much empathetic before, you know, and just really focus on understanding what I'm doing now. Is it having an impact? Yes, no. And if it doesn't, what should I be doing differently? I think COVID-19 is a way for us to have assess our lives a little bit differently and really look at our communities from a different lens.
And real quick, give a shout out to your favorite animal welfare or animal rights related philanthropy so people can give, and I'll do the same for my favorite.
Oh, the San Diego Humane Society.
Love it. Love it. And mine would be Silver Muzzle Cottage. It's a rescue association in Michigan, of all places, that works nationally to support older dogs who have been abandoned and disabled dogs.
That's beautiful. I like that.
Silver Muzzle Cottage. So what a pleasure, Aurelia. It's been a real, real enjoyable experience having you on and learning about your background and all of your experiences that led you to this moment in time and all of the things that you're excited about going forward. And with that, we're going to turn it over to Mark.
Thanks. And I want to mention my favorite charity for animals. It's called Bay Path Humane Society of Hopkinton, Massachusetts. A wonderful operation.
Love it. What's their MO?
They take in dogs and cats, and you can go there and adopt.
Excellent.
My daughter has volunteered there. I've gone there, and it's a wonderful, wonderful organization.
It.
And it's right at the grassroots. It's right at the where dogs and cats can leave this earth. They come in and save them.
I love it.
So this has been wonderful. I really, Aurelia, it's been wonderful to meet you and chat with you and learn about a real wide variety of things. And I really appreciate you joining us.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining Garnett and Mark on the Innovation Podcast. Visit theinnovationpodcast.co to subscribe and listen to other episodes.